University Forum is a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University, which brings speakers to the campus to lecture on a variety of topics. The opinions expressed by the speakers do not necessarily represent the opinions of Nebraska Wesleyan University or of this station. Today, University Forum presents Nancy Lieberman-Klein, United States Olympic basketball silver medalist, network television basketball analyst, and sports promoter, and her presentation, Women Supporting Women. Lieberman-Klein's presentation, which will examine the role of women in sports, was one of several Nebraska Wesleyan events scheduled for February 3rd and 4th to celebrate National Girls and Women in Sports Day. Since her introduction to the sport on the playgrounds of Brooklyn, New York, Lieberman-Klein has revolutionized basketball for women. At age 17, she emerged as a leader of an American team that won the gold medal at the Pan American Games in 1975. In 1976, she became the youngest basketball player in Olympic history to win a medal as a member of the silver medal-winning United States team. Lieberman-Klein was also a member of the 1980 United States Olympic team, but did not participate because of the boycott. As the top draft choice of the Dallas Diamonds of the Women's Basketball League, Lieberman-Klein turned professional in 1980 and led her team to the championship of the Women's American Basketball Association in 1984. In 1986, she was the first woman to play in a men's professional league, signing with the Springfield Fame of the United States Basketball Association. She was also a part of the Harlem Globetrotters Washington Generals World Tour in 1987-88. In 1989, following a decision to allow professional athletes to compete in world competition, Lieberman-Klein was selected to be a member of the United States national team. Lieberman-Klein has also been active off the court. In the 1980s, she was recognized as a driving force behind Martina Navratilova's rise to the top of the women's tennis rankings, serving as her conditioning coach. Lieberman-Klein was the first female named to President Ronald Reagan's Sports Drug Awareness Program and currently educates youth on the hazards of drug and alcohol abuse through New York Governor Mario Cuomo's anti-drug student leadership program. An accomplished broadcaster, she continues to serve as an analyst for network broadcasts of men's and women's games, including work for NBC's coverage of the 1988 and 1992 Olympics, CBS Radio, and ESPN. Currently a resident of Dallas, Texas, Lieberman-Klein is also the owner of ProMotion Events Incorporated, an Omaha, Nebraska-based sports marketing company. Join us now for University Forum and Nancy Lieberman-Klein.
Thank you. I hope I have a big coach's voice because usually when I'm around coaches, they don't need microphones. I usually need microphones when I speak or when I'm doing TV. So I hope everybody can hear me well. You know, yesterday I had the opportunity to be in Washington, D.C. For some of you who don't know, February 3rd was National Girls and Women in Sports Day. It's been a proclamation for the last 5 years, and our presidents have taken time out of their busy schedule to meet with some prominent athletes. Not only did we get a chance to go to the White House yesterday, the athletes that were invited to Washington, sponsored by the Women's Sports Foundation, we had an opportunity for each of us to go to our respective senators and reps and aides and congressmen and talk about certain issues. We all went out on Capitol Hill. Athletes like Cheryl Swoops, Lynn St. James, the auto race driver, myself, Patty Sheehan, the golfer, Kim Zemeskal, the gymnast, Julie Crone, the female jockey. It was a real interesting day for us because not only were we there as world-class athletes, we were there as women trying to share some issues with the people that will eventually make the law, change the law, or keep the law where it is for us in reference to Title IX and also to gender equity. Some of the issues that we wanted President Clinton and Mrs. Clinton and Tipper Gore to hear were issues about how important sports is for young girls and young women, how important Title IX has been to women like myself for the opportunity to have education, for the opportunity to compete, for the opportunity to be able to grow just like any little boy would in the same type of environment. When we talk about gender equity, and that seems to be the buzzword right now in our society when it relates to sports and especially at the NCAA convention in San Antonio a couple weeks ago in early January. Really, one of the issues is that sports participation is simply too important from a physical, psychological, sociological, for the well-being of our children to only have it benefit our young boys. It has to be there for young girls and for our daughters. The real bottom line is the debate over gender equity in sports. And sports participation, it has been said that if girls participate in sports, that there are significant health implications. This is not true. The other issue is contrary to popular belief that football will not diminish or not die in its popularity around the country or revenue-producing ability if girls and women in sports have the opportunity to play. It will not happen, and I will substantiate as we go along some of these issues. Unfortunately, the debate over gender equity in sports has been portrayed to the public as a choice between girls' sports and boys' sports. It's not true. The other myth circulating continues that football is the proverbial goose that lays the golden egg, and that if it dies, all remaining men's and women's sports supported by its revenues will also die. This also is not true, because football is not the proverbial golden goose. And one of the most important factors between women being involved in health, and I'll go systematically down a couple of points for you to think about. High school girls who play sports are 80% less likely to have unwanted pregnancies. 80%. How many scholarships are given around this country to kids who are non-educated, and then they get pregnant, and then we don't know what to do with them? 80%. As long as they play sports, we at least have a chance to keep them out of those type of situations. 92% of young girls are less likely to become involved with drugs. They're three times more likely to graduate from high school. Point two, as little as 2 hours a week of exercise can reduce breast cancer in a teenage girl. 2 hours a week of exercise, that's not a whole lot. One out of eight American women will die of breast cancer. You have certain things that you're in control of. Exercise, your prerogative to exercise, is one of them. None of us are prepared to have our daughters suffer the results of generations of women who were not permitted to play sports early on, like my mother or my grandmother. They were told that there were significant health implications if they played sports that put a lot of pressure on the muscle-bearing bones in their body. I mean, it doesn't get any worse than that. I mean, one out of every two women over the age of 60 years old, my mother, grandmothers, people like that, they suffer from osteoporosis because they never had exercise when they were a young girl, because they were told that they would have health problems if they were involved in sports. Girls and women who play sports have higher levels of self-esteem and lower levels of depression. Girls and women who play sports have a more positive image and experience higher states of psychological well-being than women who do not play sports. You know, if you've ever participated as a young guy growing up in sports, you got a lot of your self-esteem and a lot of your confidence from how you interacted, how you competed, how you pushed yourself to levels you didn't think you were capable of doing. It's the same thing for young girls. They need to have those opportunities. Sports is where boys have traditionally learned the values about teamwork, about goal setting, the pursuit of excellence in performance, and other achievements oriented to behavior. The critical skills that are necessary in the workplace, they have learned because of their participation in sports. And if you think about it, in the future, with the way our environment, our economy is today, where the quality of our children's lives will be dependent in the future on two income families, it is very important that our daughters have the same type of opportunities so they can be competitive, highly competitive in the workplace, just like our sons. And this is a very real issue. If they don't have the ability to learn to be competitive, to grasp and to work on those life skills, how are they going to be able to earn the jobs that they want to in the future? And again, it's right there. You read it every day, what the economy, what's happening economically in our country. One of the most important issues I'd like to discuss today, I'd like to talk about Title IX. I'd like to talk about the 1972 Education Amendments Act. I'd like to tell you what Title IX says. Then we can talk about compliance, what has and has not happened. We can talk about some things that we can do to comply with Title IX, but I hope you'll find some of this interesting. The Title IX of the 1972 Education Amendments Act prohibits discrimination on the basis of gender in the provision of educational programs and activities in all secondary and post-secondary educational institutions that receive federal funding, which means with regard to athletics, Title IX addresses three basic equal opportunity requirements. One, you must be able to participate. Absolutely, number one. Number two, scholarship dollars. Number three, other athletic programs and how they will benefit. First, our school's obligations are to provide athletic opportunities to both men and women in proportion to the enrollment of the student body. Thus, if College X has 55% male student body and undergraduates, and there are 45% female student undergraduates, athletic participation should reflect that 55-45 mix. That's how the money should be split, or athletic participation. The only defense for not providing these numbers of opportunities are if the institution already has met the interests and the abilities of women athletes, if they've shown a continuing expansion of opportunities for women over a period of time, if they have shown that they're going in the right direction, trying to give some funding to women's athletics. But it should also be noted that this requirement does not refer to equal number of teams. I said that it has to do with a 55-45 mix in athletic participation, individuals, not necessarily teams. If participation opportunities must be equitable, for example, if an undergraduate student body is 55-45, male to female, and there are 400 athletic scholarships available, there should be 220 given to men and 180 given to females. That would be the right proportionate distribution of those scholarships. Second, scholarship dollars must be provided to male and female athletes proportional to their athletic participation. What I mean is, if a school is spending $400,000 a year on athletic scholarships, half of their participants, athletic participants, happen to be women, well, $200,000 should be given to women, $200,000 should be given to men, if that's the direct split of the percentages of the numbers. And third, the institution must provide equal benefits for male and female athletes in areas of equipment, uniforms, supplies, provision of quality coaches, which is so important. If you have a good coach, they're paid correctly, you're going to be able to get a better benefit from those individual coaches. We're also talking about locker rooms, practice facilities, scheduling, recruiting, traveling, and other programs that an athletic program might have. Now, equal dollars are not necessarily required. For an example, if it costs $1,000 to outfit a men's football player, you don't have to necessarily give $1,000 to outfit a young woman's basketball team, a uniform for a basketball player. The institution must simply spend what it's required to provide for that woman as long as it's the same quality. It doesn't necessarily have to be the dollar. As long as she has the same quality uniform that is provided by her counterpart in the football program. Some questions that are always asked of us when we're talking to our senators or our congressmen is, are educational opportunities, are educational institutions, are people complying with Title IX? And I can tell you in the last 20 years that Title IX has been here, there has been very, very little compliance because nobody ever thought that anybody would raise the issue. No, the university, some of the presidents, nobody thought that women athletes or coaches would sue the universities. And our nation's high schools and colleges have virtually ignored the requirements of the federal law. I mean, if you break a law, there's a penalty. Here, people have been breaking laws as far as distribution of funds for 20 years, and there's been no penalty. The only people who have been penalized are the female athletes who haven't had some of those opportunities that some of the guys have had. Over female athletes, just to give you an idea of some of the numbers, and really, as I researched all this, I'm telling you, it is mind-boggling to me, as it is, I'm sure it will be to you. Female athletes comprise 53% of our college undergraduate student population as of 1990. 282,512 of those student athletes participating at the NCAA level right now, as of 1991-92. Only 96,467, only 34% of all the people competing in NCAA sports as of 91-92 were women. Only 34%. That doesn't reflect the mix when I tell you that 53% is the undergraduate enrollment. Right there, there's not compliance with Title IX. I mean, somebody is not complying with the numbers that have been researched by the actual the U.S. Department of Education. Contrary to popular belief, men's sports participation has not suffered. I would never want to take a scholarship away from a young man to give myself or somebody else a young scholarship. I'm not here to tell you to yank things away from guys and give it to girls, because I don't think that that's right either. But men's athletics has not suffered over the last 10 years. There have been 16,242 more male athletes in 1991-92 than there were 10 years prior in 81-82. So they've increased by over 16,000 athletes. For every two female participation slots for athletic scholarships created in the last 10 years, with Title IX in place, 1.5 slots have been added for men. So it's not like we're gaining two and taking two. Men are still increasing. We're increasing by two. They're increasing by 1.5. So they're growing as well as women who continue to grow. I mean, some of the discrepancies in athletic opportunities at institutional levels, at Division I, 69% of the athletes are male, 31% of the athletes are female. At Division II, 68% of the scholarships or the athletes are male, 32% are women. At Division III, let's really get down to Division III, 67% are male and 35% are female. That doesn't correlate with the 53% that we talked about earlier. There needs to be some compliance. Female athletes receive less than 24% of athletic operating dollars, less than 18% of recruiting dollars. Female athletes receive less than 33% of all athletic scholarship dollars that Division I has. Again, it's not in compliance with the law of Title IX has said. Male college athletes as of 1992 get $179 million a year more in athletic scholarships than women. You know what? I don't know about you. It doesn't seem fair. How can we have $179 million less? Something has to be done to equal the scales some way. In Division I-A institutions, women's programs receive only 18% of total budgets. The proportion of African American athletes in sports programs is significantly less than in men's sport programs, primarily because the effect of a large number of black athletes play football. But I mean, we talk about minorities, women being minorities. The people who absolutely, positively get it the worst are young female African Americans. They are on the lowest totem pole when it comes to opportunity, when it comes to funding. It's not the way it should be. They deserve every opportunity as I would have. They deserve any opportunity as you would have. And the way the funding is right now, you know, we talked about the black, you read, I'm sure, about the Black Coaches Association. They went to the NCAA convention in San Antonio. They were so upset that they did not have their 14th and 15th scholarship. This was the big issue at the convention. Who's going to get that 13th and 14th scholarship anyway? It's not going to be one of your stud athletes. It's probably going to be one of your local kids, maybe a white kid that maybe is from the local area. We're fighting for 13th and 14th scholarships. What about the young African-American women who never have the opportunity? Because there's such few chances for them to have opportunities. And I'm thinking, if this is a real racial issue, why aren't those black coaches fighting to give those opportunities for minority women? If they really care about the issues, the minority issues. But all they care about is making sure their programs are stacked with scholarships so they can give it to the kids that they see fit athletically. Whether that's right or wrong, I think the issues thus become confused at what they really do want. 28% of our nation's athletic programs, there are no women administrators. Athletic directors, associate athletic directors, assistant athletic directors. Are we not that intelligent? I mean, are there no women who can run an athletic department? Mary Beth. I mean, you've got to give your job back. The stats here say you're not supposed to be doing this. Why is she an exception? Why can't Mary Beth be the norm? Are women not capable of handling administrative situations and chores and finances? Yes, they are. But the way it has come down now, those opportunities are not there. You're very fortunate. You're one of the few. Even though in over 300 of those schools, there are at least three athletic administrative positions, they do not go to women, they go to men. A woman has a better chance of becoming president of the United States than she does being an athletic director at a university. I mean, well, maybe we should tell that to Hillary, because maybe she probably will be the next president next time we go around, since she's running the White House for us. Or at least she told us that yesterday. There are only 9 women among 105 athletic conference commissioners in the nation. 105 athletic conferences and 9 women. And 4 of those serve as only the women's sports commissioner. They don't oversee the whole program. 5 hold a commissioner's position in a conference governing both men and women's sports, but none serve as the head of a Division I-A conference. Hard to believe. I mean, these are honest to God facts. And I mean, it's right here. If you've not heard it, you'd be surprised at the disparity in the percentages. The NCAA has failed to provide strong leadership at its member institutions with regard to Title IX compliance. Only 9% of faculty representatives at the NCAA convention are women. Only 23.4% of all the delegates at the 92 convention were women. And historically, the NCAA has argued against the inclusion of athletics in Title IX regulations. So here, that is one of the reasons that there are not a lot of women in power decision-making positions at the NCAA level, because they're not even in compliance with Title IX. How can they put a woman in that position who's obviously going to fight for what's right, or at least try to get what's right and make some changes, but you can't put a woman in that position because it goes against what you're already doing. 48% of women's teams, of all women's teams, are coached by women. Less than 1% of all men's teams are coached by women. Can you imagine? I've been to 2 Olympics. I've played in men's professional basketball leagues. I've played in women's professional basketball leagues. I do clinics with Michael Jordan, Magic Johnson. I've done the last 2 Olympics for NBC. I do Big 8 men and women's basketball games. Can you imagine somebody coming to me and saying, "You don't know enough about the game to coach the guys. You can coach the girls because, you know, you, Nancy, you know so much. You have so much experience. But, you know, you just don't know enough to coach the guys." How can that be? If I know enough to coach women, how can I not know enough to coach the men? It seems, again, there are just a lot of inadequacies in the hiring process. And, again, I mean, I think if I chose to be a basketball coach at Nebraska Wesleyan, is the men's coach here? I could coach this team if I chose to. How long is this contract? But the way society has it, I wouldn't be qualified in their mind to coach a men's basketball team, which is absolutely crazy. About 5,900 jobs existed in 1992 for women head coaches. In the last 10 years, head coaching jobs for women have increased by 812. Women hold 181 more coaching jobs today, 181 more coaching jobs today as they did in 1982, 10 years ago. Men hold 631 more jobs as women coaches than women did. So what's happening is some of the guys that maybe are not getting jobs in men's basketball, well, the alternative is, with hopefully gender equity and Title IX and more funding, they're seeking positions to coach women's basketball teams because they know that it's an opportunity to build a program. Just like if you love the game, you're going to go wherever you can to coach. But if you love the game as a woman, you're limited in where you can go to coach. Less than a third of the committee positions at the NCAA are held by women. That percentage drops 20% among the NCAA's most powerful committees. The numbers reflect a minimum representation that limits the NCAA when they opened the doors to women in 1981. There has not been a significant increase in women who were let in. Some have been let in, but they're not on any committees that wield any power or substantial power or that can make some significant decisions as far as where funding and money go. At the high school level, data is practically non-existent to get your hands on. So at the high school level, some of the information that has been given to us in research is 34% of all high school athletes are women, and there's reason to believe that high school institutions directly mirror the college situation when it comes to how their funding is split up from the government. We're not saying that we should eliminate any of the men's sports. That's not what I'm saying. We're just saying that rather than eliminate non-revenue sports for men, let's try and find areas that we can cut back and we can find extra dollars. You know, people think that Title IX and gender equity is going to take away men's minor sports. It is not. It will not take away men's minor sports. What we need to do is find areas. If we own a corporation and our corporation is losing $638,000 a year, well, I tell you what, you've got to get rid of some of the excesses. You might have to get rid of some administrative people. You might have to reduce your budget. You might have to cut your travel. You might have to get rid of the cellular phones and the mahogany desks. You might have to get rid of the 11 coaches and cut down, pare down. So we're not saying reduce your scholarships. What we're saying is cut the fat. And 93% of those institutions right now, the football programs, are not making money. As I said, 45% of them are losing $638,000, but they want to increase their expenditures when they're losing money. I guess the issue becomes, can we comply with Title IX without hurting the participation of men's athletics? And I think we all agree that participation opportunities and direct educational benefits to student athletes are the most important things for maintaining athletic programs at a higher education. Then other cost-saving, revenue-producing measures can be pursued to try and cut. Instead of, I would say reducing squads would probably be the last thing you would want to do. A couple areas that we might think about for cost cutting to increase revenues of men's minor sports and women's sports at the institutional and the conference levels. The women's market is virtually untapped as far as marketing and promotions. There were at least 13 schools in Division IA last year that generated over $1.3 million in revenue. These are women's athletic teams. There were at least twice that earned over $400,000 last year in revenues for their program. So there is evidence that indicates that sponsor and spectator the donor market for women's sports can be an area that can be tapped into in the future. And it can be different from the ones that the men's athletic department taps into. Therefore, maybe developing a new market will not put women's sports in a competitive position, but it will also a competitive position as far as funding from the men, but it'll at least give them another area of bringing some revenue into their program where they can at least be self-sufficient in certain areas. We would encourage college conferences and college conference members and high schools to adapt the same sports when expanding programs in order to realize financial savings of a competition with a regional geographical proximity. So if you're scheduling, take that into consideration. It costs a lot of money to fly around in this time, in this economic time for us. So, again, if you're losing money, you have to look at, well, how can I play so-and-so, and where are they, and how can I get to them? Maybe establish a conference-level presidential review requirement for the control of athletic administration staffing. You know, it's hard to police ourselves because sometimes we do it. It's almost like, you know, President Clinton in Whitewater. You know, he wants an internal review board because maybe he can, and I'm not saying he is manipulating, but he could have influence on it. Well, with an external review board, if they truly are separate from the situation and they take a good look at it, they can be very objective. Well, maybe we need to have the same thing in athletics. Maybe this presidential review board at the different conference levels can come in and take a look at, you know, the college level and say, well, maybe the plush locker rooms and the indoor facilities and the recruiting and the expensive game of let's beat the Joneses, maybe they can try and control some of the expenditures that were going on right now that has been virtually impossible to stop at a national level. And it's difficult for institutions to argue that they would like to stop it because they feel that they have to compete with other colleges. But if there was one board that can control it all, maybe in unison, there could be some cost-saving measures. Maybe we could create inducements for gender equity that would prohibit the allocation of an automatic national championship if the school does not achieve compliance with gender equity. Florida State, give back your trophy. You haven't complied with gender equity. You know, maybe the hardest thing, like they say with athletes, is if a Shaquille O'Neal gets fined $500 a game, what does it mean to Shaquille O'Neal? He makes $30 million a year. If you suspend Shaquille O'Neal for 5 games and he's making $300,000 a game, maybe it hits him a little bit harder. If a school does not comply with Title IX, well, maybe they're not entitled to win the national championship, even if I do. Maybe there are some ways to at least make people take a serious look at what they are and are not doing within their athletic programs. At a high school level, we might prohibit the advancement of postseason play for boys' teams if it's not providing equal opportunity for girls. Maybe we reduce institutional expenditures that do not exactly reflect the participation, as I said, of a student athlete. Maybe we downsize athletic staffs. We get rid of the plush conference rooms, the cellular phones, as I mentioned. You know, put a moratorium on new facilities and plush locker rooms and state-of-the-art, you know. Like a theater like this is what the football team watches their game films on. Maybe they don't need an amphitheater. Maybe they just need a VCR and a TV and a guy with a stick going, "Hey, you missed a tackle here, buddy." Maybe that's what they need to do, just like Vince Lombardi doing his teams. Maybe we try to restrict the off-campus recruiting. Recruiting's very, very expensive. Or housing. I was at Texas A&M last week speaking, and I ate at their athletic dorm, and I thought I was at the Red Lion. I was thinking, this is one of the nicest colleges I've ever been to. The food, I was telling one of the basketball players, I went in the athletic dorm, and the food that they had at A&M, they had steak and lobster, they had shrimp, they had all the... I was thinking, I'm leaving my husband. I'm going back to college. This is great food. Well, somebody is paying for it. Somebody's getting fat at A&M. And I don't know if it's the athletic budgets or if it's the athletes, but they have it made. I mean, it was fantastic. Maybe we eliminate the private jets and work on some, as I mentioned, figuring out some shorter routes, how to travel over short distances. And maybe you restrict team play, and these are all suggestions. Maybe you restrict team plays during the regular season. And again, I mean, if you're good enough to get to the national tournament, you're going to win all your games. But maybe you don't have to make that trip to Anchorage, Alaska, or make that trip. I mean, the reason why schools budget for trips to Hawaii or Alaska or California is because it's a recruiting enticement. It allows you to look at a kid and say, look, we go to Hawaii, we go here, we go there. I mean, I know, that's how I was recruited, along with the plane and the car that I got. No, I'm only kidding. Old Dominion did not do that. This is being recorded? I think the statute of limitations ended for Old Dominion. Maybe we need to legislate within the NCAA reductions in the amount of non-need athletes aid that institutions may award in each sport with certain goals in mind. Maintaining competitive distinctions between all divisions. 2, maintaining the current number of student athletes who do need to receive such aid. And 3, not reducing aid levels of athletes who qualify. I mean, I know that there were kids still, or when I was playing basketball in college, we were getting our athletic scholarship, we're also getting financial aid. I mean, it was like we were double dipping, and maybe there's a way to regulate that and maybe get some financial aid and get some scholarship money. But, such reductions need to be accompanied by changing all sports to an equivalency rather than a head count. Sports with limits placed on the total number of student-athletes who may receive this type of student aid. Maybe we need to revise the NCAA revenue distribution formula to provide one unit for every men's sport over the minimum requirements and 1.5 units for every women's sports over the minimum requirements, or a similar or more advantageous weighing for women's sports and a more advantageous weighing for women's scholarships than men, just to kind of start getting some equality in how scholarship dollars are distributed. Now, the big question that I get asked everywhere, and I have to tell you that in December, I was the first woman to ever sit on the dais of the Heisman Trophy dinner. It's hard to believe that this dinner's been out there for so many years, and there's never, ever been a woman with all those wonderful athletes. And I had the opportunity to sit with Charlie Ward and with Coach Bobby Bowden. And Bobby is a big advocate on, I think that if we give, he thinks, you know, the golden egg theory, because maybe Florida State is one of the 7% of those schools that really does have incredible revenues. But the way we can work and the way we can comply with Title IX without actually hurting men's football, I mean, I would never want to see Nebraska football hurt. I mean, I think it's fantastic for the state. I also would like to see all the other programs at Nebraska do well, or Nebraska Wesleyan or whatever college. For instance, I don't know if some of you remember the old football player for the St. Louis Cardinals, Jim Hart, the quarterback. Well, I happened to play in a golf tournament with Jim this summer, and he is now the athletic director at Southern Illinois University in Carbondale. And I asked him, I said, Jim, what's your take on all this gender equity stuff? He said, Nancy, to be honest with you, I can tell you right now, if you took 30 scholarships from my football team, you would never see the difference on the football field. He said, because all we end up doing is stockpiling those kids and redshirting those kids. And we could take some of those scholarships and give it to men's gymnastics or men's track and field or men's swimming or some maybe women's athletic programs. He says, we're talking millions and millions of dollars. He said, I also want to make sure I can get my women's basketball coach to the same level of as pay as my men's basketball coach, because I think she does a great job. I think she does the exact same work as her male counterpart, and she deserves to have equal pay because that's what the law says, and I want to abide and comply with Title IX and the federal law. He says a lot of my brothers don't feel the same way because, Nancy, they're used to having these beautiful, as I've said before, these beautiful state-of-the-art, you know, electronic screens and offices, you know, like in the Dean Dome. Have you ever, anybody ever been to the Dean Dome in North Carolina where Dean Smith can, like, push a button and, like, all the window shades open up, and then he can press another button if the glare's too much, like a little sheet type of thing will go across so he doesn't get too much sun in his eyes, and then he hits another button and this big screen can come down, probably like watching Michael Jordan eat Wheaties or something. He has, do you know that that building costs hundreds of millions of dollars? And, you know, like Sylvia Hatchell, the women's team is number 4 in the country. It's the first time that there's ever been in basketball a number 3 ranked men's team and a number 4 ranked women's team the same week of the poll. Sylvia Hatchell's office, I think this podium is bigger than her office. I'm not sure. And she's got the number 4 ranked team in the nation, and they average about 4,000 people a game. But we're talking about not just the basics. We're talking about the extravagances that we have. I mean, I've earned my ring and my watch, and I don't want to give it back. But if you're losing money, if you're a corporation that's losing money, you've got to do something to cut the fat and to cut the extravagances so you have money for your program to run. And some of the football coaches don't want to do that. They just don't want to give up the perks that they already have. And it could help men's sports as well as women's sports. So when we talk about compliance with Title IX, those are some of the things we talk about that maybe some adjustments could be made in the actual divvying up of how those funds and how expenditures are. And you know what? The bottom line here, and if you think about it, we really can't choose between our sons and our daughters. I mean, I hope that, you know, when I have a child, I hope that my daughter has the same opportunities in life that my son has, because she'd be deserving of those rights. And if she earned the right for a scholarship and couldn't have one because there was no funding, you know, it would be really scary for me to know that maybe she would have to turn to something else, and I hope that something else wouldn't be drugs or alcohol or just make bad decisions because she didn't have a good area of her life to express herself. A couple things that I would like to make clear that are probably not. Higher education officials must monitor carefully employment and program practices in intercollegiate athletics if women are to grow in equal opportunity in athletic programs, especially in administrations that are merged. And lastly, educational institutions cannot judge a coach on the amount of revenue that is produced. A professor here at Nebraska Wesleyan is not judged on how much money he or she brings into this university. They're judged on equal pay for their work and their job description. That's what the law says. That's how they're paid. The law says that coaches are paid equal pay for equal work and job description. So the misconception is that people think coaches are hired on can they put people in the seats and can they generate revenue. That is not true. That's what some people would like to see, but that is not true. And we can't confuse revenue producing with the deficit at the end of the year. For example, I'm a businesswoman. I have a company in Omaha, Nebraska. If Nebraska men's football grosses $10 million a year, but they spend $15 million a year, they're operating at a $5 million deficit. If Nebraska women's athletic program makes $1 million a year but spends $1.3 million a year, they're operating at $300,000 loss. Look at the bottom line. Men make a lot of money with these programs, but they spend extraordinary amounts of money. And you have, as a business, you have to look at the bottom line. Who's going to cover that $5 million deficit? And then they say, well, we're trying to take scholarships away from their guys. It just isn't so. The media has not portrayed it correctly, and a lot of the public just doesn't understand what the law says and what the issues are. And, I mean, clearly, as I said before, we just can't choose between our sons and our daughters or girls and boys.
Everybody should have the opportunity to be what they want to be if they work hard. Now, I'm a living example of that. Like I said, without a scholarship, I wouldn't be here today as your speaker, and I wouldn't be able to share some of this information. It's changed my life. It's given me my confidence, my self-esteem, and I hope that I can do more off the basketball court than I ever did on the basketball court to give young people information, to give people information about, you know, what our needs and what our desires are. If anybody has any questions, I would be glad to answer anything about some of the numbers, or I know we're running kind of short on time.
Today's guest on University Forum has been Nancy Lieberman-Klein, United States Olympic basketball silver medalist, network television basketball analyst, and sports promoter. Her presentation was entitled Women Supporting Women. This has been University Forum, a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University. Nebraska Wesleyan is an independent undergraduate liberal arts institution, nationally recognized for excellence in teaching and the high caliber of its students and faculty. Approximately 1,400 full-time students are enrolled in more than 40 major programs.